MechCast, Thursday, April 2nd, 2020. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I hope you are having a good week, I have to say. Things are not going too badly for myself, although, you know, I've been at home for 3 weeks and not really gone out and seen anybody other than virtually. So, getting a little bit stir-crazy, but I think that's okay. We're having fun. I got the family around, and hopefully you're staying safe and you're comfortable and things are going okay for you. Also, hopefully you're spending some time reaching out to friends and family virtually and supporting where you can. We're all kind of in this big crazy thing together. It's a really weird time. And, you know, at least we have technology, right? Technology is making this not quite as bad as it might be. And of course, along with technology, that means we got Apple and Mac news to get into. So maybe take our minds off of that and stick to what's going on cool in the Apple world. And we do have a lot of cool things to talk about in this episode. Apple playing around with VR tech. They've been doing that for a while, but we have some news about a company they've been possibly working with. We're going to talk about the A12Z Bionic processor and why it may seem a little bit familiar. Also, we have updates on when we might see the first ARM-based Macs. That's been being thrown around, but we have new updates from one of our favorite analysts. We're going to talk about what the next series Apple Watch might look like. Apple putting out some new Windows software. We'll explain what that means. And also, we've got a lot on iPhone updates and an interesting new acquisition for Apple to round out the news this week. And then we're going to talk about Apple TV app improvements. Yeah, things have gotten better on the Apple TV app. I noticed a few things this past week, and I want to share those with you. Also got some great advice from a listener on maybe how to make the Apple TV experience a little bit better. We've been talking about Apple TV and Apple TV Plus on the last few episodes, so this is a nice little continuation of that conversation. Also, Apple gave us some new toys to play with a recent iPad update. I'll talk about my experiences with that and maybe give you some tips and tricks for playing around with it yourself. And then a listener pointed out a feature that's in iOS that's pretty cool. I hadn't really played around with it too much, but yeah, it'll help you do some things with your iPad and annotations and a few other cool stuff. So that'll round out this episode of the MacCast. I don't want to waste any more time, so we will just dive right in to the latest news. Starting off with Mac Rumors, who found a photo, interesting image inside iOS 14, the betas, that appears to look like a generic controller for AR and VR headsets, similar to a design that was used in the HTC Vive Focus headset. You may remember back in 2017, Bloomberg's Mark Gurman had reported that Apple was using HTC Vive hardware for internal testing of some of their AR and VR efforts. We've also had a ton of rumors, of course, about Apple's ongoing AR and VR research and development initiatives. It's pretty well believed at the current time that Apple is working on maybe some smart glasses, maybe some other AR VR technologies, and we're expecting Apple could release an AR VR headset sometime in 2021 or 2022. So this seems to be further evidence of those efforts. The setup is likely at this point just something for internal testing, although there does seem to be an AR app also available inside iOS 14, something called Gobi. It lets you launch various augmented reality experiences related to the Apple Watch, the Mac Pro, Apple stores. They also have a demo for Starbucks and a movie poster, all activated supposedly via a QR code. The report that I was reading also mentioned one experience that described something called crosswalk bowling, basically a bowling game that would come up in AR across a crosswalk at an intersection. This one in particular only being able to be activated near an Apple office known as Matilda 3. So definitely something that is, you know, specific to Apple, and their R&D efforts around around iOS. But that's a pretty cool thing, and something, you know, I don't know if we'd want to be playing games near the street corners, but interesting demo nonetheless. I would imagine they're using the lines on the crosswalk to help sort of set up the AR experience, and that's why they're using a crosswalk. But I don't know how practical that actually would be. Another thing in the AR realm, that report we got this week was that Apple also recently partnered with a London-based AR systems startup called Dent Reality. This is pretty cool. The two companies are supposedly collaborating on Apple Indoor Maps to provide indoor navigation. They basically have some AR technology that can overlay directional information on indoor spaces. In an announcement on Twitter, Dent said that they were setting up projects with Apple for later this year. So I'm thinking maybe this is something we might see in a demo at the Worldwide Developer Conference, which is happening. It's just happening virtually this year. So they're going to do it a little bit different. And this totally seems like the kind of thing where Apple would set up the tech, create a demo, and show some really cool indoor mapping AR technology. So that'd be, you know, really cool stuff for, say, malls or airports when you need to find your way to a specific destination or location indoors. And it's pretty neat stuff. I guess the developer of the startup kind of started with AR technology in just a personal GitHub project and then founded this company. And now it looks like they're working with Apple. So AR, VR, definitely something that Apple is looking to push forward in the near future. Now that Apple's new iPad Pros are out and hitting the market, we're starting to see some analysis and teardowns of people running them through their paces. And this week, we got a couple of reports that were surfacing from sites like Notebook Check and Anand Tech that are questioning the newness of Apple's A11Z, or A12Z Bionic processor that is in that new iPad. Early benchmarks are showing just marginal performance improvements over the A12X Bionic that's in the 2018 iPad Pro models. And according to some of the sources, really the only difference in the A12Z is the addition of an 8th GPU core. And that's likely in there to provide some additional boost and support to the new really, really cool LiDAR AR camera sensor technology that's in there. But what's being questioned is that eighth core is really something that is part of a new processor, because analysis of the A1210 chip, or A12X chip, excuse me, shows that the GPU likely has an eighth core that was simply disabled by Apple. So the question now is, because the design and form factor of the A12Z Bionic appears identical to the A12X Bionic, did Apple simply enable the eighth core on the A12 Bionic and then rebrand it marketing-wise as an A12Z? And it's looking like that is probably exactly what did happen. The really big question in my mind, though, is this really a big deal or not? And personally, I think not really. You know, technically, the A12Z is a new version of the A12X with a more powerful GPU with that extra core. And so it really is an iterative update, and it was given an iterative name. And how Apple did it, in my opinion, is really kind of beside the point, right? It's a marketing thing. It is a better processor. They can slap a new name on it, even if it isn't really all that different, and it still makes a really cool product. You know, the biggest takeaway for me is that this is just another indication that outside of the new LiDAR system and camera features, there's not much need to upgrade if you already own a 2018 iPad Pro model. And as somebody who often spends quite a bit of money upgrading to the newest, latest, and greatest thing, it's nice to maybe have a reprieve from feeling like you have to do that just to get a couple new features and maybe some new enhancements. So I think this is a great new model for people who are in the market for an iPad upgrade. But for those of us who have a 2018 model, maybe now we can just upgrade to that really cool new Magic Keyboard case and have what feels like a really refreshed iPad this year. And so I'm kind of actually looking forward to that. Now, that said, that new LiDAR system is looking super, super cool, and it may be worth the upgrade all by itself, depending upon what developers end up doing with that. But we're already starting to see some really cool demos and videos as developers are getting their hands on these new iPads and playing around with the tech. They kind of show these mesh overlays on a lot of the videos that show how it scans the room, and it's in real time just basically building this 3D mesh landscape. And you can go room to room, you can do it multiple rooms, and then take that data and start using it. You can even start having virtual objects interacting on screen with the physical objects in your space. So it's going to be amazing for gaming. It's going to be amazing for 3D applications. And it's also expected that this year's iPhones are going to adopt that LiDAR technology for the rear-facing cameras. So I'm looking forward really to see what developers do now that they have this technology available to them. I think it's going to take ARKit and Apple's AR stuff to a whole new level. So is 2021 the year of the ARM-based Mac? Ming-Chi Kuo seems to think so, according to his latest research note. That might be sooner than some of us were expecting, but Kuo claims that Apple has started a, quote, aggressive processor replacement strategy. In previous reports, Kuo seemed to think that Apple's plans could result in ARM-based Macs appearing as soon as the fourth quarter of this year, but it's now looking like he has revised that prediction. And he thinks the move will bring numerous advantages for Apple, including reducing the dependence on Intel and their processor roadmap, which has hindered Apple quite a bit in the past. He also thinks on the financial side, it could reduce Apple's processor costs up to 40-60%, which means for Apple, probably even better profit margins. And then he also thinks it'll bring more hardware differentiation from Windows-based PCs, although I don't know how much more of that Apple really needs. That's always a good thing, I guess. But I think this is more about Apple and their need to kind of control everything end-to-end, really kind of controlling their own destiny when it comes to their hardware and software. And with the success of their processors on other platforms like the iPhone, the iPad, the Apple Watch, AirPods, I think Apple has more than demonstrated their ability to create some amazing processor technology, and it's pretty exciting to think about them bringing that to the Mac platform. You also have the advantage of they can probably make very power efficient chips, and it could do a lot for their designs and just the technology across the board. So I'm looking forward to seeing an ARM-based Mac. It'd be fun if it happened this year, but it's looking like it's probably going to be happening in 2021. Now, Kuo also thinks that the release will increase demand for Apple notebooks going forward. He says that Apple currently sells about 20 million Macs a year, and he thinks that moving to ARM-based systems could take that number up to 30 million annually. So, that differentiation, that excitement, driving more Mac sales as Apple brings those models out, hopefully sometime in early 2021. We're starting to hear a lot more about what the next generation of Apple Watch might look like, the Apple Watch Series 6. And this one might be the one that finally gets me to upgrade from my Series 2, but not necessarily because I really want to, because of the fact that part of the rumor is that Apple Watch, or Watch OS 7, rather, may drop support for the Apple Watch Series 2. So kind of forcing you into that upgrade maybe earlier than you want. Although, you know, my Apple Watch Series 2, if I'm being honest, is starting to feel a little bit long in the tooth. But looking at the Apple Watch Series 6, what new features can we expect? What kind of new fun tech do we get to play with? Well, rumors are saying that it could include sleep monitoring, a blood oxygen sensor, and Touch ID. Now, the Touch ID feature, we've kind of heard about two sort of implementations, under the display, and what is probably more likely, the integration of Touch ID into the digital crown. It's thought that the Apple Watch Series 6 will have it on the digital crown, and maybe a future generation like the Series 7 could finally bring the under display tech. Although, as many of you know, that technology has been problematic for a lot of Apple's competitors. So if Apple is really going to bring that tech to bear, they are going to make sure that it is rock solid and that they do it right. Other rumored featured enhancements for the Apple Watch Series 6, updates to Siri Intelligence, letting Siri do more on the Apple Watch, support for LTE and Wi-Fi 6, a larger battery, supposedly to help support that sleep tracking feature, although it's also been mentioned that there might be a little enhancement in the software to remind you to just top up that battery before you go to sleep. So basically, take it off, put it on the charger as you're getting ready for bed, and then pop it back on when you lay down. We're also hearing possibly getting improvements to the ECG capabilities on the Apple Watch. And as far as design, the Apple Watch Series 6 is expected to remain pretty much the same, if not exactly the same, as the current generation Apple Watch. On the software side, WatchOS 7 is expected to include a new workout demonstration app, shareable watch faces, and a kids mode for the activity rings. This is pretty cool because, you know, kids don't need to have kind of the same activity goals as adults, and so these changes would adjust how daily goals are calculated to make them more appropriate for kids, doing things like changing the move-based goals from the amount of calories burned to more specifically the kind and amount of kinds and amounts of activity that a child is participating in throughout the day. As I mentioned, WatchOS 7 unfortunately may drop support for Apple Watch Series 2. That remains to be seen, but it seems like it could be likely. And as far as when we might know a little bit more about Apple Watch and WatchOS 7, WatchOS 7, I would expect we get some features shown off at the Virtual Worldwide Developer Conference in June, and then the hardware will likely be announced in the fall alongside Apple's iPhone announcements. Here's possibly a bit of good news for you video pros out there, especially if you work cross-platform. It looks like Apple is finally bringing their ProRes technology to Windows. This enables playback of ProRes RAW and ProRes RAW HQ video files in compatible applications on Windows. The support is coming in beta form to several Adobe apps on Windows, specifically Adobe After Effects Beta, Adobe Media Encoder Beta, Adobe Premiere Beta, and Adobe Premiere Rush Beta. So this is great news for video professionals, as I mentioned, and I have to say, it's about time. You know, Apple, anytime they can do, I think, cross-platform support, it is a good thing. They seem to resist it, though, right? And if we're being really honest, they seem to kind of drag their feet when it comes to this stuff. You know, for example, where is FaceTime on Windows? Where is Messages on Windows? You know, we could go on and on, but at least we're getting ProRes support starting out there. Hopefully they'll roll it out quickly to other applications. And it does seem like maybe now they are recognizing that there are advantages to offering cross-platform support and support for cross-platform workflows, because a lot of, especially video pros out there, do have to go across multiple platforms, and they're not necessarily going to give up their Macs just to do Windows, but if you need to go back and forth, why not be able to take the great Apple ProRes codec and use that cross-platform? So good to see Apple moving in this direction, and like I said, hopefully that support and that kind of support continues. In iPhone news this week, we don't have any one really big story. We kind of have a moderately big story and then a bunch of little ones. So I thought I'd just kind of roll these out in a little iPhone potpourri of stories, starting off with likely the biggest announcement, which may even be a thing by the time you hear this podcast, honestly. We're hearing that we could see an announcement of the iPhone 8 SE 2, what's been being called the iPhone 9. iPhone 8 SE 2 is my thing, as you probably know. And we could see that announcement happen in the next day. I'm recording this on April 2nd. We're hearing that Apple could announce the new device on Friday, April 3rd. It was expected that they might have been doing an announcement later in the month, but maybe that got stepped up. Regardless, by the time you hear this, you may see a new iPhone SE, and yeah, we are hearing that Apple may simply call this product the iPhone SE, trumping what everybody thought, because a lot of people were saying iPhone SE 2, iPhone 9, but nope. Latest rumors, iPhone SE only, just simplifying the name and making a throwback, although it's going to look nothing like the iPhone SE 4-inch model, because it's actually going to look almost identical to an iPhone 8. It will reportedly be available in three color options, white, black, and product red, and will come in three available storage sizes, 64, 128, and 256 gigabytes. Same form factor and design as the iPhone 8 without 3D touch. It'll have that single lens rear camera. It will bring in NFC support and offer the same A13 processor that is currently found on the iPhone 11 and iPhone 11 Pro series. It's also going to come with that nice low starting entry price point, US $399, according to most of the rumors. And there has been a few things that seem to support a imminent release. Belkin glass screen protector showed up on Apple's website in the last day or so, listing support for the iPhone 7, the iPhone 8, and the iPhone SE. And considering the fact that the iPhone 8 is a very different form factor than the original 4-inch display iPhone SE, it seems likely that that name may be the one that Apple chose and might be the one that stuck. So like I said, you may already be able to get your hands on this by the time you hear this podcast. Hopefully this prediction turned out to be right. We also got some new info this week on the new car key feature that may be making its way to iOS. Got a little more information about how it might work through some leaked screenshots. It seems to be integrated into the wallet app, so you can add keys in there for supported NFC compatible vehicles. Apple's going to be reportedly working with auto manufacturers to add that support, and it will allow users approaching their vehicle to simply hold their iPhone or Apple Watch near an NFC reader in the vehicle, authenticate with Face ID, and then have the ability to unlock and even start the car automatically. You'll also gain the ability to share keys, and when you share those, you can give and set up different kinds of access, things like access to trunk only, access to unlock only, and access to unlock and drive. I don't have a modern vehicle. I still use the old school key that you plug in, but I know a lot of people with more modern vehicles are excited about this new tech. The iPhone 12 with 5G support still does seem to be on schedule for a fall release. Despite everything that's happening in the world, manufacturers are said to be beginning to get component orders lined up. And we heard this week that TSMC is already beginning to do volume production on the new A14 processor using their 5-nanometer process. The latest betas of iOS 13, iOS 13.4.5, seem to indicate that there's a new feature that will allow you to share songs from Apple Music on Instagram or Facebook stories. tapping a song on the Instagram story, then lets the user play the song on Apple Music, I assume with a subscription. And I would presume that if you don't have a subscription, what you're presented is a nice little trial offer and an offer to sign up for Apple Music. So this is looking like a great way for Apple to promote Apple Music on Instagram and Facebook. Not a thing that thrills me, but I know a lot of people are into that, and that's kind of a cool new feature that may show up in the next release of iOS 13. Another really cool thing that happened this week is Amazon Prime's video app for iOS and Apple TV seems to now let customers make in-app purchases, including the ability to rent and buy films and TV shows directly from inside the app. You could do it with an Amazon subscription directly through your Amazon account, or if you've signed up, which you can now do in Amazon Prime, for Amazon Prime in the app through an in-app purchase subscription, you can use your Apple account to make purchases. This was not available before, and it seems like Apple and Amazon have come to some sort of arrangement or agreement to make this all happen. So that's cool, good news for those of us who use Amazon Prime Video. And then finally, it's looking like Apple may have spilt the beans on one of their own future products. We'd heard about the rumored AirTags, but it now seems that there was a support video that showed up on Apple's official YouTube channel that showed a screenshot of the Find My iPhone screen, and in the description text for one of the toggleable features, say that three times real fast, there was a reference to AirTags. It said, quote, offline finding enables this device and AirTags to be found when not connected to Wi-Fi or cellular. Apple quickly removed the video, but there you have it. It's looking like AirTags may be a thing, and they may be just around the corner, especially if Apple has versions of the OS that they're using in demo videos that indicate the feature. AirTags, if you don't know, are the rumored Apple tile-like item trackers that take advantage of the new U1 ultra wideband chips that are in the iPhone 11 and iPhone 11 Pros to allow you to locate real world objects in the Find My app. And we've been talking about these for a while. Should be a pretty cool thing. We were expecting them to come out earlier this year, but we haven't had an announcement yet. So it's looking like it could be imminent. And that's kind of your roundup of the latest iPhone, iOS, and iPhone-related news for the week. And then finally, Apple has acquired Dark Sky, the weather app. This came about in an announcement on the Dark Sky blog. It was also announced that with the acquisition, the Android app will no longer be available for download, and that its services and support will end for Android in July. Dark Sky for iOS will continue to be available through the App Store, and the API, which is used by third-party apps like Carrot Weather, will continue to work through the end of 2021. It's expected that Apple has plans to roll the Dark Sky technology into their own weather app sometime in a future iOS update. Will it happen in the next version of iOS? That might be a little bit tight on the timing, but it wouldn't be surprising to see Apple show something off at WWDC. I would imagine it'd be fairly easy to integrate the API since it's already available, so maybe their engineers will hop right on that, but we'll have to wait and see on that one. You may or may not know that Apple's current app uses data from the Weather Channel's weather.com, which is owned by IBM, so I would suspect, again, this is another case of Apple really wanting to control their own destiny when it comes to data and information. It also helps them kind of keep a control on privacy, another thing that Apple is really focused on. So bringing that stuff in-house, having their own service, and I have to say Dark Sky is absolutely one of my favorites. I think they have some of the best data out there. So it's somewhat of a loss to our Android brethren out there, but probably good news for us Apple and Mac fans. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, right now might be a great time to set up a new server. Maybe you've got a project you want to get going. Maybe you want to set up something like a GitHub server or maybe a gaming server. You can do that instantly and easily with Linode. You can deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. You can get everything up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and even choose from any one of their 10 node locations. As a matter of fact, they just opened up their newest data center in Mumbai, India, and that one's built using their most up-to-date hardware, next-generation network backbone, and would allow you to comply with any in-country data protection requirements, all while taking advantage of Linode's latest, greatest technology and tools. And best of all, they're giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit. And Linode is way more than just hosting. With Linode, you have all of the options and choices you need to build whatever kind of server you want. You can do dedicated CPU servers. You can do distributed applications, hosted services, websites, continuous integration, and continuous delivery environments. And all of their servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors. Pricing is simple with no surprise fees. You pay for just what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their cloud manager makes it super easy to manage everything. It has a new improved user interface, which makes upgrading your plan and managing all of your services in Linode's super simple. If you want to check it all out, visit linode.com/maccast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com/maccast, linode.com/maccast. And a huge thank you to Linode for their support of the show. We've been talking quite a bit on the past few episodes about Apple TV Plus service and the quality of their programming, and that Apple does seem to be really living up to the quality over quantity equation, despite what critics might think. Most of you have written in to tell me that you're enjoying a number of the shows. Not everything, and it seems to vary the shows that each person likes, depending upon their own tastes, but it is feeling like Apple has at least a handful of quality shows for most people. And that's great. But one thing we haven't talked too much about, and maybe have talked about in the past somewhat negatively, is the Apple TV app. I have not been a huge fan of some of the recent iterations, but something happened the other day. I was in the TV app and I started noticing a little bit of minor improvements. Nothing real life-changing, but some nice little enhancements. A big complaint that I've had since Apple brought out their Apple TV Plus service was that there was really no kind of one central location where you could go to find just the Apple TV Plus content. Apple basically had their shows kind of crammed in and around all of the other content. And I think part of that reason is because the app was originally designed to kind of plug into the third-party apps that you would install onto your Apple TV or onto your iOS device, right? And then you'd kind of link them into the TV app. Of course, Apple TV Plus doesn't have its own app. It just exists inside the TV app itself. Well, it looks like Apple might be listening to some of the complaints or may have noticed that this was a problem, because as I was browsing through, I noticed a new row called Apple TV Plus. And in that row, you can scroll through and finally see all of the Apple TV Plus shows that are currently available. There's even a See All link that you can tap on, and that will take you into a standard grid view representing Apple TV Plus and all of their shows. So finally, at least that is there. You do have to scroll down a little bit in the interface to get to it, but there now is an option. So that was pretty nice. Another complaint that I had was that the streaming apps that you link in are again all kind of interspersed in and among all of the other content, and that content may or may not be content that you subscribe to, all those recommendations, all that thing, all the things that Apple tries to serve up to you to maybe upsell you some of the Apple channels, and maybe you want to subscribe to those, maybe you don't, but it's like this hodgepodge. But because I link in my other apps, say Amazon Prime and Disney Plus and Hulu, the ones that I actually do subscribe to, obviously the TV app knows which content I do have access to. And there's never been a really good way to kind of browse into that content. Well, Apple has made a small step forward in that realm as well, because again, once again, as I was scrolling down through the content, I noticed a new section called streaming apps. It was way down in the interface, but it does show the streaming apps that I have connected to my Apple TV Plus. And as long as I only connect the ones that I subscribe to, those are the only ones showing up in that list. Now, unfortunately, it looks like some apps are not supported yet. And I also did notice that when you go into browse those streaming apps, the recommendations are all coming out of that one streaming app, and there's a bunch, but it really just stops at recommendations of certain shows from that service. It is not the full catalog. You can't browse entirely through inside the Apple TV app, which is what I'd really like to do, so I don't have to jump out to the third-party app. But you can get in and find some of their hottest and latest shows and some of the recommendations that they would recommend for you based on your watching of that service. And so it works pretty well, but if you need to dig deeper, you do need to click through, and it will jump you out and launch you back into the host app. So I think that's probably a nice compromise that Apple had to make. But I did notice that for me, Hulu, Disney Plus, Amazon Prime, and Pluto TV were there and available. I also have access to ESPN, but that didn't seem to be there and supported. And I do also have the CW app installed because their content is all free or ad-supported, and that's not one of the streaming apps in that section yet either. So hopefully they continue to expand and grow that out. But again, another nice little improvement to the interface. So things might be getting better. And I did get some good advice from a listener this week. Jill wrote in to say, hey, one thing that you might want to do is turn off and disconnect any apps that you don't subscribe to that might have been installed. So I've installed a bunch of apps like the NBC app and ABC and CBS, and they offer some free minimal content that I thought I might want to get into and watch. So I had installed them at some point. I had connected them into the TV app so that it would share that data and share my watching data. And as I found out when I took Jill's advice and kind of disconnected it, it was polluting things a little bit. So you may not remember that those apps are installed or that you have them in there. You don't have to deinstall them from your Apple TV or your iOS device, so you could still go to the individual app and get the content. What you want to do is just go in and disconnect it from the sharing the data with the TV app. And when you do that, you probably also want to tell it to forget the history to kind of clean things up even further. And what's nice about when you do that is it cleans up a lot of the suggestions and recommendations. Now, unfortunately, you're still going to see a fair amount of promoted channels and a lot of content in that Watch Now section, and those recommendations will still come from apps that aren't installed, that you don't have access to, which I still find really, really annoying. But at least now, with disconnecting some of these apps, there's some better ways to maybe navigate around that stuff. And it does make the experience a little bit better. I'm still waiting for the day when Apple gives me a toggle that says, hey, in the TV app, only show the content that I actually have access to. That would be awesome. It kind of started out that way and they moved away from it. I get it. They have to promote those other services. They have to keep those other service providers happy so that they'll want to integrate with the TV app. And so it's this little game that Apple has to play for now. But slowly and surely, I think it will get better. And one final thing, I want to give you a couple quick tips because Jill was mentioning some frustrations with using the Apple remote to kind of navigate around between the TV app and the home screen and, you know, having a menu back. And it was a little bit cumbersome. And so it reminded me there's a couple tips that not everybody knows about with the Apple remote. And the two of them are if you press the TV button from no matter where you are in the app, if you haven't changed the default setting, that TV button will take you right into the TV app. Or if you're deep down inside the TV app, you can tap the TV button to get all the way back quickly in one click to the home screen. You can also press and hold on the menu button from anywhere inside any app to simply return all the way back in one step to the Apple TV home screen. So those are two ways to quickly jump all the way back and kind of reset yourself from wherever you might have gotten if you've delved too deep into the Apple TV TV interface. And I think that that works whether or not you're using the virtual remote on your phone or your iPad or your iOS device, or you're using the physical remote. So just some Apple TV app improvements and a little tip there for you. So we now live in a world where you can use a trackpad or a mouse with your iPad. If you have a newer iPad and you have a supported trackpad or mouse, USB or Bluetooth, you can now connect it to your device with the release of iPadOS 13.4. And when this came out, I was excited to try it out. I downloaded it immediately and I took the opportunity to play around and test it out with my Apple Smart Keyboard and my second generation Magic Trackpad. And I have to admit, as much as in the past I felt that the iPad needed to remain pure to its touchscreen roots, using my iPad Pro with a keyboard and a mouse was pretty darn great. Apple has done a really good job putting this experience together. And I think the reason it works in this configuration is for the same reasons I have dismissed in the past the idea of Apple ever doing a touchscreen notebook computer, because of the issue of what I call the planes issue. Not the things that fly in the sky, but the actual physical planes of existence that the different surfaces operate in, meaning your display versus your keyboard and your trackpad. I've always felt that the experience of moving your hands between two different planes is inefficient and also somewhat uncomfortable. It's not really the best way of working. So I think a touchscreen iPad works great when it's flipped around and you're just using it with one hand, because you're interacting with a single plane, a single surface, and your hand is moving across that. Even if you're holding it up, you're still oriented in, you know, kind of one plane. Same thing when you're using a notebook with a trackpad and a keyboard. Your hands stay across the same physical plane. You're not going from an X to a Y axis. So you're not, you know, making that change. And that's never really felt comfortable. Even using my iPad with just the Smart Keyboard always felt like a bit of a compromise. It was great for typing, but anytime you had to go up and do something on the screen, it kind of broke you out of the flow. It broke you out of that experience. And so bringing mouse and trackpad support changes that experience. It makes it, in my opinion, much better. And so I really enjoyed using it that way. As far as having like a second or detached physical devices in terms of a Bluetooth keyboard and a Bluetooth trackpad, that wasn't all that great. You know, you're going to end up carrying like three things around. But again, that's why I think the experience of using an iPad with the new Smart Keyboard that Apple is bringing out for the iPad is going to be a really great experience. And I'm almost sold at this point on getting that update when it comes out. We still don't know when Apple is going to make that available. They have it up on their website. They're teasing us with it, but it's not available for purchase yet. So hopefully that happens in the next week or so, because I'm itching to get my hands on that and to try it out. Now, when I did start using my second generation Magic Trackpad with the iPad, I did run into a little bit of an issue with some of the gestures, because I had read that there were some cool gestures for doing things like getting to the home screen, activating the app switcher, and all that sort of stuff. And I did read in advance that the first generation Magic Trackpad and the first generation Magic Mouse, along with some third-party mice, don't fully support all of the gestures and features that are available in iOS, specifically the additional three-finger gestures or the mouse scrolling gestures. But I was confused when I started using my iPad Pro with my second generation Magic Trackpad, because I couldn't seem to activate any of the three-finger gestures, even with the Magic Trackpad 2. And in case you run into this yourself, it turns out that there actually is a setting, and it's not a setting that Apple mentions in any of their support articles. I immediately went to their support articles to figure out what the problem could be, and I was only met with, hey, if you have a first-generation trackpad, these gestures won't work, but if you have a second-generation trackpad, then they should work, but they weren't working for me. So there is actually a gestures setting in iPadOS. If you go into Settings, General, Multitasking, and Dock, you need to make sure that the gestures setting is enabled. I think it is enabled by default, but I think at some point I had disabled those multi-touch gestures on the screen because I was activating them accidentally or when I didn't really want to activate them, and I didn't use them that much, so I think I disabled it at some point and it was turned off for me. But I had to go on and hit the community up on Twitter. Luckily, the MacCast community, of course, as you know, is amazing, and several of you got right back to me and solved my problem. So thank you for the tech support. But that got me thinking, you might also not know all of the gestures that are available with the new iPadOS 13.4 and trackpad support. So here are some helpful ones to kind of get you going. If you want to open the dock, you can use one finger to swipe the pointer past the bottom of the screen. So if you take it all the way down to the bottom and keep going, then that will pop the dock right up for you. If you want to go home, you can use one finger to swipe the pointer past the bottom of the screen. Then after the dock appears, swipe the pointer past the bottom of the screen again, and boom, that will take you right home. Or on a Magic Trackpad 2, if you have the gesture support turned on, you can swipe up with three fingers, and that'll get you back to the home screen. If you want to activate slide over, using one finger to swipe the pointer past the right edge of the screen will do that. To hide slide over, you just swipe over there again. If you have multiple slide over windows too, you can kind of sweep through them with a two-finger gesture when you're hovering over the slide over windows. So you can flip through and have multiple slide over windows open and work through it that way. If you want to open up Control Center, you can select the status icon on the upper top right and then swipe up with one finger. So that's like the clock and other icons that are up there. You just put your cursor up there, it'll kind of highlight it. And then if you just swipe up again or swipe to the right again, swipe up again with one finger, it will open up the Control Center. You can open up the Notification Center by using one finger to move the pointer past the top of the screen near the middle. So if you do that, that'll pop down or pop open the Notification Center. And then again, if you have a Magic Trackpad 2, there's some additional gestures. You can open up the App Switcher with a swipe up of three fingers, pausing before you lift your fingers. So you kind of swipe up with three fingers, pause for a second, and then that will pop open the App Switcher. If you want to switch between apps, you can swipe left or swipe right with three fingers to jump between your open applications. If you want to open up the search, you can swipe down with two fingers in the middle of the home screen. And then you do have the ability to do a secondary click or kind of a right click by clicking with two fingers, and that will give you access to any of the quick action menus that you might normally have access to when you're just touching on the device. So if you haven't had a chance to play around with the new trackpad mouse support on an iPad, I encourage you to do so. It's actually pretty darn neat. So check it out. That was kind of my experience. And if you want to share your experience and maybe even some tips and tricks with us, that would be awesome too. Shoot us an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. Lastly today, I want to finish up with a feature that was pointed out to me by a MacCast listener, Chris. Chris works for a school, and while at home exploring ways to do remote learning, he was looking into how to mark up papers electronically so that teachers could do that and send them back to their students. So he was playing around with some of the screenshotting features and the markup features, and while doing that, he noticed that on his Mac, when his iPad was nearby, there was a little icon on the screen that had a pen to it. It looked like a picture of a screen with a pen next to it. And then tapping on that ended up opening up the screenshot he was working on his iPad, and then allowed him to do the markup on his iPad. And if you have an Apple Pencil, you can use that. And while you're doing that, you can see the markup actually happening live on the Mac. So it's going back and forth and showing you in real time the markup from one device, almost letting you use your iPad like a Wacom tablet so you can do your markup and then send that back to your Mac. That's a feature called Continuity Markup. And it has been around. You basically start with a screenshot or any PDF image on your Mac in the Finder. And then what you can do from the Finder is select the document and press the space bar to open up the preview window. You can also do this from, Chris discovered, taking a screenshot and then being in preview with that screenshot. You'll see the icon as well. But if you want to just pick a document, PDF or image file in the Finder, you can activate Quick Look using the space bar and then click on the markup icon at the bottom of the window. You can also control click on the document and under quick actions choose markup from the shortcut window. And then once you're in markup, in the markup toolbar at the top there, you will see that little annotate button, the screen with the little pen icon that Chris had discovered. Tap on that, and then what will happen is a markup window will open up on your device. And now you can use your finger or your Apple Pencil and all of the sketch tools that are built into iOS 13 to mark up your document. You can tap on the plus sign to get access to additional tools like arrows and things for adding signatures, accessing the magnifier, all of the shapes, mark up your whole entire document, and then when you're finished marking it up, you can tap done on your device. That will send it back to your Mac, and then to save the changes on your Mac, you tap done there, and boom, you have your marked up document. So that's cool. It relies on having a Mac that supports Continuity, but you can do that. There's also a similar feature called Continuity Sketch. This one's pretty cool. With Continuity Sketch, what you can do is you can use your Mac to request a new sketch from your iPad, iPhone, or iPod Touch, and then insert it into a Mac document. So this works with a lot of your different document applications on your Mac. Basically, you open up a document, and from the menu bar, you choose File, Insert From, and then the name of a nearby device. So if it's your iPhone or iPad, it'll say, you know, Insert From iPhone, Insert From iPad, and then you choose Add Sketch. And this works in apps like Pages, Numbers, Keynote, also some third-party apps. You'll have to play around to see which ones are supported. And just be aware that in some apps, the feature is accessed through the File menu, and others, it's from the Insert menu. I think it's actually from the Insert menu in Pages, Numbers, and Keynote. I think you can also control-click or right-click inside your document and access it from the shortcut menu as well. So there's a few ways to activate this. Once you do activate it, again, then on your device, a sketch window is going to open up. It's going to allow you to draw a sketch with your Apple Pencil or your finger. And when you're finished doing that sketch, you tap done, and the sketch will then appear and be inserted directly into your Mac document. I think this also works with notes, if I'm not mistaken. So another really cool feature. Again, all of this is dependent upon you having devices that are running the latest versions of the operating system and that support the continuity features. So what you're going to need is you're going to need an iOS 13 device. It needs to be an iPhone 6S or newer, an iPhone SE, or an iPod Touch 7th generation or newer. If you're using an iPad, iPadOS with an iPad Pro, all of the models that are currently available, an iPad 5th generation or newer, an iPad Air 2 or newer, or an iPad Mini 4 or newer. And then on the Mac side, you need to have macOS Catalina, and a MacBook introduced in 2015 or later, a MacBook Air introduced in 2012 or later, a MacBook Pro introduced in 2012 or later, a Mac Mini introduced in 2012 or later, an iMac introduced in 2012 or later. I guess I could have just said most Macs introduced in 2012 or later, an iMac Pro, all of the current models, and the Mac Pros since 2013. All of those support the continuity features, and you would be able to do this with those combinations of devices. So that was pretty cool. Thank you, Chris, for pointing that out to us and sharing it with us. Hey, if you have a cool tip or trick for Mac or iPad, iPhone, Apple Watch, it doesn't really matter. We want to hear about them. Let us know your coolest Mac, Apple hints, tips, and tricks. You can shoot those to maccast@gmail.com, and we will try to share those on future episodes of the MacCast. And if you want to do an audio comment, an audio version, that's awesome too. Just, you know, attach and send me an MP3 file, any kind of audio file. It really doesn't matter. I just ask that you try to keep it relatively brief. 2 to 3 minutes is usually an ideal length. So if you can target that, sometimes I know it's hard to do. You're okay if you go a little bit longer, but, you know, keep it brief, keep it short, and we'll also share those on future episodes of the MacCast. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank my show sponsors, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com, and all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You will find them at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. Phone number 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to find me on social media, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or you can find me on Instagram as MacCast. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.